This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net and by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
This week, we interrogate Scott Feibusch and find out the truth behind his calendar full of naked towers.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And this week our panel of inquisitors includes Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, and Scott Feibusch.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show that's all about radio technology and the engineers who make it happen. Yes, the men and women who keep the music playing and the microphones humming and the transmitters on. It's all about that and how we get those things done. We've got a really good show for you today. I'm especially excited to have with us our guest, who I'll introduce in just a moment. But first, let me introduce our cast of regular characters. First of all, there's me. I'm Kirk Harnack, and I work for the folks at Telos, Omni, and Axia. There, I'm fully disclaimed now. Also with us on the show today, from New York, is Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kirk. How you doing tonight?
I'm good. And who's your disclaimer today?
My disclaimer today is that I didn't know this was about radio. I thought it was about trains. You said engineer, but no. I'm vice president of engineering for Buckley Broadcasting. Work out of WOR Radio in New York City, and that's my disclaimer.
Cool. And also with us from lovely downtown Manhattan, Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you?
I'm good. What's up with you?
Oh, not much. Just staying warm. It's very cold in New York today.
Yeah. And if you
render, we have a cold spell.
And if you render an opinion on the show, it's paid for by, but not necessarily that of.
Well, my disclaimer would be my employer is CBS Radio.
Yep. I don't know why it seems so important we do that. We did the first show. We forgot to mention who pays our bills. That is our personal bills, not the show's bills. And we got a few complaints. You didn't say who so and so works for.
So. There's always one in the crowd.
There is. And speaking of that one in the crowd, it's Chris Tarr.
God.
Thank you very much.
Chris,
I work for my wife, Amy, because if I don't do what she says, I get in big trouble. work for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, where it's probably cold.
It's 18 degrees right now.
Holy cow. What is it in New York?
We have it at New York City is, I think, 19 or 20 degrees right now.
Oh, gosh.
Actually, bear with me one second. I'll tell you what it is here in New Windsor.
Got about a half a foot of snow coming tonight, so we're getting ready for that.
Do you really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to get some more snow and some more wind to whip it all around.
It is 25
winter in Wisconsin, paradise.
8.5 miles an hour of wind here in New Windsor, New York, about 50 miles north of New York City.
Well, I got you all beat. It's a balmy 28 degrees Fahrenheit in Nashville, Tennessee.
All right.
We are expecting.
Well, y'all down there, you know, that's like freezing for you all down there.
It is like freezing.
I'm going to die down here.
But, well, you laugh. My stepfather lives in Phoenix, Arizona. It was like 60 degrees last week, and he called me complaining it was cold. I said, how would you like to come up here? I'll go down there for a week.
Bunch of lightweights. Come on.
Well, let's bring on in the show our guest for the day, a man who is not a stranger to cold at all, from Rochester, New York. It's Scott Feibusch. Hello, Scott.
Hello there.
Hey, we're glad to have you in. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Scott.
I'm here. You cut out for a second, but I got you again.
Okay, good. All right. Well, Scott is our guest today, and we're going to spend virtually the whole show talking with Scott about some of the things that he does. Scott Feibusch, if you are an engineer, if you're in radio broadcasting, the name Scott Feibusch should not be unfamiliar to you. But I'm going to let Scott tell us some of the reasons why his name is familiar to most of us in broadcasting. And I think Scott's most famous thing is that hoo-hoo calendar that he puts out every year. So, Scott,
yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What are you involved in right now, and why do we know you?
Well, I get to disclaim myself?
Oh, absolutely.
Cool. I put out for now 9 years running the allegedly world-famous Tower Site Calendar, which every year features a little over a dozen images of famous interesting broadcast and broadcast-related sites from around the U.S. and Canada and sometimes even further afield. For the last 15 years now, I've been editing a weekly column called Northeast Radio Watch, which chronicles the doings of radio and TV in the northeastern U.S. and eastern Canada. I edit the Radio Journal, which comes out every Wednesday, chronicling what's happening in radio engineering all over the country. That's the old M Street Journal under a new name.
Okay, all right.
I do 100,000watts.com, which is a radio directory site. And believe it or not, they even let me get on the air every once in a while at WXXI here in beautiful, balmy Rochester, New York.
And well, indeed, you and I were talking earlier this afternoon. You apprised me that your report, your weekly report, was going to be on WXXI, and I was able to tune in. Of course, the phone rang while I was listening to it, but to the online stream. But it was good. What you were talking about, was it HD or home theater technology?
This one today was talking about the threat, allegedly, to free television.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
The spectrum grab and going on from there to talk about the increasingly complex relationships between cable companies and TV broadcasters, which should, if nothing else, make us all glad to be working in radio at the moment.
Martha, they're taking away our free TV. What are we going to do? We write the congressman.
Is that something that's going to be overheard in, around the dinner tables of America?
For the 9% of people who still rely on over-the-air TV, maybe, yeah.
Is it really just 9%?
It depends on the market. You see different numbers depending on who's trying to make a point, but... And there are markets where you've got like 95% of people getting their TV by cable or satellite now.
Hmm.
And there are others where you've got about 60. So.
I want to get into the calendar subject later. Let's save that a bit. Tell me about this this website that you've been doing forever, this report you've been doing, Northeast Radio Watch. Now, I don't live in the Northeast. I did when I was a little kid. But we don't have anything like, you know, we don't have Nashville or Tennessee or Mid-South Radio Watch. But you have Northeast Radio Watch. What is that all about?
It began way back in the deepest recesses of the early internet, before the web, back when we were all just doing Usenet. And you remember that group, Rec Radio Broadcasting, that Bill Pfeiffer used to do?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Back when. He started around, must have been about 1994, getting people to be radio watchers in their local areas. And there were a bunch of people who contributed reports from their various local areas of what was going on. And I started doing New England. I was living in Boston at the time, and I started doing New England Radio Watch. And it evolved into a weekly column, kind of outlasted the Usenet era, turned into, at one point, a mailing list, and then eventually turned into a website, and has been going weekly now since, well, weekly in about 98 or thereabouts, and has lived ever since at fibewish.com, where it appears every Monday morning, unless it's a holiday or I'm on vacation. And has become, I like to think of it as sort of the journal of record of what's happening in the industry, both programming and business and technology, all across the northeastern U.S. and up into eastern Canada.
So that was my next question, actually, you just answered it. And that was, you cover programming, and, like formats and format changes, business, the business of radio stations, and the technology, if somebody makes a power increase or what a transmitter site move. Yeah.
Exactly. And I try when I do that, because I know that my audience is not entirely geeks. And so I try to make it reasonably understandable and reasonably interesting. And then I get to sit down a couple of days later and do Radio Journal and get deeper into the geekiness of it all.
How do you become apprised of these changes? You must have a heck of a network of friends to let you know what's going on. Or do you have some secret websites that you check in on?
I'll tell you, it scared me to death when I moved from Boston back here to Rochester in 97. I was thinking, okay, how am I going to keep covering Boston radio from 400 miles away in upstate New York? And the answer turned out to be that it wasn't all that hard. That was right when streaming was starting to come in. And so usually, you know, if somebody's doing a format change, I'm listening to it on the stream when it's happening, having gotten tipped to it. There are some great websites out there that are... Yeah, message boards are not always the most reliable things in the world, and you've got to apply a liberal helping of road salt to them, but you can get some good tips that way, at least get a sense of something's about to happen, even if you're not getting the full story about what's happening. There are just a ton of people out there now who will email me and say, hey, you didn't hear this from me, but program director in Augusta, Maine's about to get blown out.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, 2 days later, the poor program director in Augusta, Maine is... out there looking for a job, and hopefully I've got the right story in there.
I'm just looking over the current edition of Northeast Radio Watch. You mean famous author Stephen King owns some radio stations?
Oh, he sure does.
I didn't know this.
He's been in radio up in his hometown of Bangor, Maine. I think he bought his first station there in the late 80s, as a matter of fact. And he's the owner that we'd all love to work for, because he goes in and says, okay, here's what I want to hear on the radio. Let's make it happen. Uh-huh. And so he's got an FM station that's playing straight ahead rock and roll. He's got an AM that's doing sports. And he bought another FM and just last week flipped it to Progressive Talk because he said, hey, this isn't on the radio up here. And let's see if we can make a go of it. He's written about it, too. You know, he does a column in Entertainment Weekly.
Okay.
And last year he wrote about, I believe the exact phrase he used was, the radio industry is in the pooper.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Which was honest, I guess. So he's still running a business up there, but he has fun doing it, and stations sound great.
What were some interesting, and I'm more interested if for this purpose of this podcast in the technical stories, your station moves, I guess, power increases. I noticed you've had to cover a couple of tower failures in the not too distant past. I think you had featured at the front of your website. What are some of the more memorable things that have happened in the last 3, 4, 5 months or so?
Well, that tower collapse was a pretty big one, not because it was all that big a tower. It was a 400-foot AM stick, but it was particularly creepy for me because the tower that was featured on the December page of my 2009 calendar was the tower that collapsed in the middle of December of 2009.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
So that was really weird when I got the phone call about it that morning. And that, by the way, is a great example of kind of the email network that I built up, because I think I had probably 7 emails within an hour of when it happened about it. But that was just strange that just by luck, the tower that I'd chosen to put on the December page, primarily because I was down there in the winter and had a nice shot of the tower with the rolling snow-covered hills of the Finger Lakes behind it. They were doing guy wire replacement, and sadly, the guy who was about 50 feet up on the tower lost his life when it came crashing down.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a sad one. I feel bad. The engineer down there, it's a guy named Tom Atkins out of Buffalo, out of Backyard Broadcasting.
Oh, yeah, I've met Tom. Sure.
Yeah, this is great guy. This is the second tower site calamity he's had to deal with in about a year, because about a year before this, one of his sites that was up on top of a ridge above Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a couple of guys were out late one night, probably 3 sheets or 4 sheets to the wind, and somehow hot-wired a skid loader. You know, those big things that you...
Doing a Bill Gates, basically.
They were driving around looking for something to drive the skid loader into when they picked his FM transmitter building. And they landed the thing right in the middle of this concrete block transmitter building. Took the station off the air. Fortunately, he had an aux site at another spot on the hill he was able to go to. But, you know, here he's just spent a good chunk of the last year getting that site rebuilt and dealing with insurance and everything. Now, boom, here this thing comes down and he's got to deal with that. So he's been busier, I think, than he would like to be at the moment.
I don't want to hog the conversation here. If any of our co-hosts want to chime in with some questions, although I was just about to mention that, Scott, your Northeast Radio Watch is about radio in the Northeast, but it looks to me like your Tower Site of the Week feature, you cover towers all over the place.
It goes all over. Wherever I travel, I try to get interesting and unique stories to go with it. In fact, I'm just getting ready in about 2 weeks. I'm headed out to Northern California. I haven't been around San Francisco in a few years, and I'm headed out there for a family event, but I'm going to take a couple of days ahead of time and go out. I've had some invitations to visit some sites out there and hopefully get some more pictures. I'm on this ongoing quest to try to get to all of the former Class 1A clear channels in the country. And I've at least been outside the sites of 24 out of the 25. WOAI in San Antonio is still the missing one. And I've been inside, I think, 19 of them so far. And those were the sites that were built as show places. Those were the sites that were built in the days when you expected that people were going to be coming by on their Sunday drives and getting tours. In a lot of cases, they still got the Art Deco architecture. Some of them still have the old big iron still in them. So those are always fun to me.
I am just so proud here. I've happened upon your visit to WSM in Nashville, which literally is 5-6 miles down the road from where I'm sitting right now. And here you've got a photo of Watt Hairston showing off the Harris DX50, 3DX50, I should say. and a picture of their Blaw-Knox Tower. You say that's the biggest Blaw-Knox of all of them?
That's, at least in the U.S., that's the granddaddy of all of them. That, you think about it, if they were all built to be about 5/8 wave, that was the lowest frequency one was ever put on. Was
650. Okay, sure.
And so it was the tallest, of course. With each of these, since this was, these were the earliest vertical radiators, essentially, that went up, they weren't really quite sure of the science yet. And in fact, this is something I've been working on for a while. I was putting together a piece on the very first vertical radiators, and with some considerable help from particularly Ron Rackley, has been real helpful with this and helping to track down some sources on it. We think the very first one was in 1931 in Boston at WNAC, and it was a Blaw-Knox diamond, but they were at the time on 1230, and so that was a relatively short one. But within the next about a year and a half, they started going up. There was one in Wayne, New Jersey, at the old, it's confusing because it was then WABC, and it's what's now WCBS. That was on 860. That tower doesn't exist anymore. And then in the summer of 32, the same crew went first to Nashville, and they put up the WSM tower, which was 878 feet when it was built.
Yeah.
And they got done putting that one up, and they drove up to Cincinnati, and they put up WLW. And both of those were just a little bit too tall. They were getting ground wave, sky wave cancellation.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, and places that you didn't want to get that kind of cancellation. Your WLW was canceling out in Dayton and Louisville and Columbus. SM, I think, was canceling out in Chattanooga and Huntsville. And so they ended up in both cases shortening the tops of the radiators. And as it turns out, and I don't know if this was intentional, there were actually short vertical sections on top that simply could be removed and were.
Okay, okay. Chris Tarr, are you there?
I am.
I was looking over Scott's website on his visit to Milwaukee.
Yes, sir.
Back in 2006. Are any of these your towers?
Yes, actually, I should be in that one, yeah. I don't know if we've got pictures of the towers, but the building we do, because it's a cool old Art Deco building.
Okay.
Yeah, we had some fun that day.
Yeah, we did. Actually, that I think that was the, we went to the nine tower WISN site at the time too.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yeah. It's always a good time when you come out here.
It is. It's funny. I'll blow into a market for a couple of days. And I get the impression too, when I do that, that the engineers in the market tend to enjoy it because it gives them a really good excuse to go look at everybody else's facilities at the same time with the excuse that, well, we're all traveling around together. So we'll all go in and gawk, and so that was a fun day because we did that. We went into WOKY that trip.
Yeah. Now one of the other things that that Kirk didn't bring up that I will, that you like to do because I geek out on it too, is you contribute to TopHour.com, which is a website dedicated to essentially legal IDs of radio stations.
Yes, there is that too. It's a fine product of the state of Wisconsin. To give you the plug there, Brian Davis up there in Appleton. Is the mastermind behind it. But, yeah, there are about six of us from around the country who, as we're traveling around, record legal IDs and put them all up on the site. And we've got, at this point, a good probably 4,000 or 5,000 of them up there.
Oh, my goodness. I'd never heard of the site. Just went to it. How cool is that? TopHour.com.
Yeah. Oh, it's a radio geek stream, I'm telling you.
Well, that's for me.
Or a radio programmer's nightmare if we catch you up there putting something that isn't.
That's right. Well, there is that, too, yeah.
So I just found this picture of the WISM array. Sure enough, nine towers all in a grid, right?
Yes, 3x3.
Yeah, 3x3.
Kind of a weird array. The scariest thing for me about it is that the phaser at that site is just a bunch of stuff on the walls of a room.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really an enclosed phaser. And so you walk in and you lean in the wrong direction. And this concludes your trip to the WISN site.
Well, that also has the grounds that are above the ground.
Yeah, I see this.
Yeah, that too.
Really fascinating site.
Well, that's a great picture. I should point people there if they want to know what an above-ground radial system looks like.
Yeah, Milwaukee is a great market for pointing out unusual stuff like that. There's just down the road from WISN, there's the 6-tower WTMJ array. It's just this massive, huge, I mean, imagine 6 towers on 620. That just blows this monster signal north from south of Milwaukee. That one I didn't visit the same day, but I got a tour of that one later on with the guys from Journal Broadcast. Great Art Deco studios there at WTMJ.
Wow.
That was a fun trip.
We'll swing back around to New York in a moment, but I couldn't help but look and notice, and I'm just so proud. You have photos from American Samoa on the website from my station, KKHJ. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, every once in a while, I try generally, particularly with the calendar, to restrict it to pictures I've taken myself.
Yeah.
And it's given me a good incentive to travel widely. I've made it so far to 45 out of the 50 states. But yeah, every once in a while, there are those places that you just look at and say, you know, the odds that I'm ever going to get there in person to get this picture, not good. And so, you know, in this case, it was your partner there, Larry Fuss, who said, hey, you want some pictures? I said, yeah, I do. And so he shipped me some pictures and explained what they were. And
I see one that I took because it was taken from up on the tower, and that would not be Larry. so you did credit me on there. So there are
a handful of those. There's that. There's Nome, Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
There's a fellow up in, I don't know if he's up there anymore, but a fellow up in Nome named Les Brown, who sent me a whole bunch of pictures of his station and the other station up there. And that one's neat, too. There's this this old aeronautical navigation station that's just falling into the tundra up there. And you got some pictures of that, too. And it's the only one, also, I think, that's ever had a picture of a reindeer in back of a pickup truck.
I just found it right now.
True story about the tower site calendar. I obviously get one every year, but I think it was last year or the year before, my now 8-year-old son got a hold of mine. And ever since then, I've had to order two because he steals mine. And so he's got a tower site calendar sitting on his bedroom wall. And, you know, this year I ordered our two, and he sat by the mail as soon as he found out that I ordered it and just sat there waiting for it to come in. It was like Christmas when the envelope arrived. Tore it open to get the tower site calendar out and hung it up on his wall.
Excellent. I love it.
So, Scott, you've personally been to most of these sites that you feature, right? There's just a few that you haven't been to. You've gotten pictures from other people.
Pretty much, yeah. As I say, I try to get to as many of them as I can personally because I want to see them. It's neat to see all the different ways that engineers have addressed the basic problem of, okay, how do I put a signal out into the ether? And the answers aren't always the same, you know, depending on where you are. Depending on all kinds of local conditions, there are certain corners of the country where there were engineers at some point, probably in the 30s and 40s, who seemed to believe that AM arrays belonged on top of Rocky Mountains.
Uh-huh.
And
So
there are just a handful of markets where you travel around. Binghamton, New York is one of those, where all these directional arrays are up on tops of hills. There's a river that runs through it. It's a nice swampy ground down near the river. And here are these directional arrays up on top of hills. Go figure, but you know, whoever was down there back in the day obviously thought that was the way to go. Birmingham strikes me as being another one that...
Well, there's a lot of rocky hills around Birmingham anyway.
Yeah.
But there's rivers too. So, of course, I got to ask you, now we'll swing back around to New York because you've got a lot of stations from there. Please regale us. What are a couple of the just zany, crazy, nutty things that you've run across or you've been traveling at with engineers to their transmitter sites? I'm sure that there's been some odd happenings during these excursions.
There have been some weird ones. One of the neatest ones that happened a couple of years ago, I tend usually to get out to the Southwest right around NAB time. You know, I'll go out for a week before the show and drive around. And this past year it was Arizona. Usually it ends up being stuff in Southern California. And the SBE chapter out in L.A. invited me to give a talk out there about a week before NAB. And I'm showing my various pictures. And there's this fascinating site in L.A. That is actually featured in this year's Tower Site calendar. That was built on top of a roof, and it was, up until last year when it was decommissioned, it was the very last hammock-type horizontal AM wire antenna that was still in regular broadcast use in the country, at least that I'm aware of. And I showed a photo that I'd taken of it just from ground level. It's real easy to see from a couple of freeways out there. And I mentioned in passing, I said, you know, I've always wanted to go up there. Three hands shoot up from the back of the room. Okay, what time tomorrow do you want to go?
Where's this on your website? Which California location?
This is KGFJ. It was KGFJ and then later KYPA. It should be down near the bottom of the California section.
I'm looking
because I just went out there just in 08. And we ended up, this is another one of those where everybody kind of tagged along. Mm-hmm. And we had probably a dozen LA people. Who are all up there on top of this roof. Yeah, I don't see it actually linked from the index here. I'll shoot you the link to it. I got to update the index with it. But we had something like a dozen people all up there on the roof checking this place out. And it was fascinating because it's built on top of the old Oddfellows Hall. And the building's in a bad part of L.A., south of downtown. And it was vacated. There are these two giant ballrooms in it that were just empty. The offices were empty. Just four stories of emptiness and one little room up top with a tiny little BE solid-state box still chugging along in the corner. And that was it for the station, and now that's even gone. But it was, you get to these corners that, you figure how many people have driven by this thing. It's right at the intersection of the 10 and the 110 freeway, or 10 and the 710 freeways, rather, in downtown L.A. Figure how many people drive by this every day, and probably not one in a million of them has any idea that what they're looking at is significant, that it's got this kind of history behind it, that it's the last of its kind in the country. And here it is in plain sight, just ready to be seen.
And what's even more fascinating is you walk through, a building like that, and you think back and imagine what it was like in its heyday, with people in the ballrooms and the building all busy and the radio station on top. I mean, that's the coolest part.
Absolutely. The station, what was left of it, was up in the top floor. I think it was the fourth floor of the building. And behind where the transmitter rack and the ATU were, because the ATU was actually indoors, and then there's just an insulator in the roof, and it just goes right up to the feed point up above the roof. And behind there is this boarded-up window that was once the plate glass window that looked down into the ballroom. The station had been on the air since 1927 from that same location.
Oh, wow.
And you can just imagine the band leader down in the ballroom getting cued to go on the air. It's enough to make you cry.
So, such a different time.
Absolutely.
Hmm. All right.
Absolutely. So that was neat. You get to go to the tops of tall buildings. I was up on top of the Hancock Building in Chicago this past spring.
Oh yeah, yeah. So some far out transmitter sites that you've been to, mountaintops or out in the middle of absolutely freaking nowhere.
What's the most unusual one that you've been to, Scott?
There's the famous Mount Potosi above Las Vegas. And there is, I think, no question around NAB time that strikes more fear in the heart of a Vegas engineer than when the guys visiting from the East Coast say, oh, by the way, could you take me up Potosi while I'm out here for NAB? Don't ask them during NAB. It is literally a full-day trip, even though you can see the thing from the strip. It is this site that's about 25 air miles southwest of the strip and about 7,000 feet up what really doesn't even qualify as anything that you would want to call a road. It starts out as this steep little bit of blacktop that you need not just a four-wheel drive, but a good four-wheel drive to get up. And you start making your way up, and then that disappears, and it just turns into rock. And eventually there's just nothing that you would even recognize as being a road, and you just keep going and going and going. And I did not drive this myself. You would not, if you don't know the road intimately. You could get really hurt out there. And so you really want to have somebody local do it. The saving grace for me, actually, as it happened, was that the CBS engineer out there wanted to show his boss. And so here I am crammed into the back of a Jeep with the local engineer and Glenn Walden in the front, bumping up this road for an hour, literally. And it's about an hour and a half drive just to get from Vegas out to where the road starts, and you're just bumping and bumping and bumping, and you get up there, and you're just up in the middle of nowhere. You'd never even realize that you've got Las Vegas down in the distance. But the reason the site is there, it's an interesting story behind it, because there are plenty of other high sites that serve Vegas just fine. There was a Class C station that was licensed to Pahrump, Nevada, which is Art Bell's hometown, about 100 miles out of Vegas. And they needed a site that would city-grade Pahrump and still put signal over Vegas. That was the only one that would do it. There was no landline power up there. They ended up running a single strand of aluminum conductor up there. And they've got their own ground at the top. They've got a ground screen that they grounded against, and then a whole room full of phase masters that, when the power feed is working, generate something that resembles three-phase power. Most of the time, they use a very big generator. And usually all winter, that's what's going, because once winter sets in, you don't go up there.
Wow. Yeah, I see the Phasemaster Farm picture on your website.
Yeah, It's a fascinating site. The guys in Vegas are very proud of it, but they'll take you up usually any time that's not an AB. If you ask them far enough in advance, it's tricky to get up there during an AB. But it's a neat site. I'm glad I went there once. I don't really ever need to go up there again. I'm probably not going to have any more kidney stones on another 2 years after the bumpy ride up there, which is a good thing. There's been some talk of improving the road up there. It's tough to get to, I'm told, even by helicopter. That is also the site where Carol Lombard was killed in a plane crash on the side of that mountain in the 1940s.
Yeah.
Which I did not realize until long after I had been up there. People hurt. I think there was a fatal accident in a helicopter going up there some years back too, as I recall. So that was certainly exotic. There are offshore sites. One of the ones that I want to try to get to before NAB this year, I want to go out to Catalina Island, 26 miles across the sea from LA.
And
see that AM site out there that they're talking about moving. I want to get out there before that's all gone.
Is that AM site going away?
They are moving it apparently closer into LA. They're going to put it up on the hills east of Orange County.
Okay.
To alleviate the troubles with having to maintain a staff out there to keep the thing up and running. There are even some exotic ones closer into home. The brand new ESPN Radio WPN 1050 site within view of the western portal of the Lincoln Tunnel there in Jersey. The towers themselves are built in the middle of a swamp. They built a temporary road just last year out there to put the towers up. And they've since pulled out the temporary road. There's a half mile of elevated wooden boardwalk that stretches out from the transmitter building out to the three towers. The phaser is actually underneath one of the towers rather than putting it at in the transmitter building. They've been on the air with that just for a few months, but that's actually kind of a hard one to get to unless you know where to start and you have the key to the catwalk.
Tom, was there a follow-up question you had?
Yeah, I had a question, Scott. Where do they keep the fuel, and how do they get fuel up to Potosi in the wintertime?
They have a huge, huge storage tank up there, and they pretty much get it full before winter sets in.
Hmm.
There's a guy who lives near the bottom of the mountain who trucks stuff up for them, and I would hope is compensated extremely well for that, because I wouldn't want that job. And wow. They have a snowcat, too, if worse comes to worse.
Wow. So, Scott, you started to touch on the the New York City market. Let's explore that a bit. New York City's been doing broadcasting for a long time, so I'm sure there are some remnants of older sites there, and then people have moved in and out and mostly in. What do you think is interesting around the New York City area?
I'll tell you what, old is getting hard to find around New York City. Over the course of the last, 40 years or so, nearly every AM site, particularly of any significance in New York, has been completely rebuilt. One of the most recent, of course, is Tom's own WOR site that went through a huge move back in, 06?
That's when the site went on the air.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to get to kind of chronicle that over the years as the old site was dismantled, the new site went in. But a lot of the other AMs have moved there as well. So there's not that much old. Believe it or not, if you want old there, you almost have to look for FM. The first FM tower, of course, was Edwin Armstrong's historic tower on the Palisades in New Jersey. And that is still standing, vintage 1937. Up there in Alpine, New Jersey, beautiful three-arm tower. There is nothing like it anywhere else in the world that I've ever seen. And the Empire State Building, I keep going up there, and there's always something else to see up there because you just have all of these rooms full of transmitters that, in the wake of 9/11, are constantly changing because they've essentially reconfigured that entire facility probably twice over just since 9/11. To make room for the TVs and to rearrange what's up there on that mast and to make room for DTV now. So that's been a fascinating one. I will actually, if I can get a quick plug in here, I'm actually going to be down in New York next week, or this week as you're listening to it, on Tuesday, the 12th of January. I'll be taking part, along with some of the other New York folks, the Audio Engineering Society, AES, is doing a little panel discussion on the 75th anniversary of Armstrong's first FM demonstrations. And that will be taking place, I believe, starting at 6:30 at the Hearst Corporation Auditorium at 8th and 57th. So any New York area listeners, come on by. Say hi.
Wow, cool. Cool. There's so many tower sites you've been to, Scott. I'm sure there's more stories that you could tell us. I was kind of curious about here in Tennessee. You've been to Nashville. We mentioned the WSM Tower, but you've also been to a couple others. I'm recognizing some towers that are just down the street from me. You said Strange Bedfellows 2 and 8, Channel 2, and then the public facility, Channel 8. That is just literally just down the street from me. That's why I get HD radio so well here at the house.
Yeah, that's a weird one. That was actually stations that traded dial positions back in the days when a low VHF channel could make the difference for you. And the public station was on 2, and the ABC station was on 8, even though it was called WSIX.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved it down to Channel 2. The public station went to Channel 8. And
I didn't know that. Wow. Wow.
Both in UHF channels now anyway. So.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned that in some areas of the country you see that engineers had similar practices, and you mentioned putting AM directionals on the tops of mountains, which to us doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You'd want to get them in more fertile ground is the usual thinking nowadays. Have you noticed any other trends in different parts of the country, maybe having to do with a single engineer who had a hand in advising people in a given area, or maybe just the era in which stations happened to get built out in a certain place, maybe in the late 30s as opposed to the early 30s, or maybe the early or late 40s as opposed to some other time? What other trends have you noticed?
Well, yeah, it depends. There are markets where you can tell that everybody was getting along, for instance, when the FMs went in, because there are markets where everybody was tremendously cooperative and managed to get into a combiner and all end up on the same tower. You know, New York, you kind of had to because you have one tall tower in the middle of the city. And then you go up to someplace like Minneapolis, and in theory, you could have put a whole bunch of towers all around Minneapolis. There's no particular high ground where FM or TV would have to be. And everybody sort of settled in this Shoreview area north of Minneapolis, and one of the biggest FM combiner systems in the country ends up being in Minneapolis. You go to other cities of similar size in similar parts of the country. You go to, let's say, Des Moines, for instance, and everybody's pretty much out there on their own site. So you kind of get a sense of how cooperative everybody was feeling at one time or another. You know, this whole issue of where do you put your AM towers. You know, I think some of it.
Yep, did we lose him, man?
Yeah, I just lost him. He'll be back in a second.
I'm still here.
Okay, hi, Scott.
There we go.
All right.
Flaky connection. But you get someplace like Binghamton.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that, you know, even the land down by the swamp was just simply more developable when you didn't have a lot of flat land in the area. And so they went up where the land was cheap up in the hills. One of the things that's unfortunate is that a lot of the history behind these decisions gets lost if nobody chronicles it.
Mm, yeah. Nobody knows why it was done this way or put in this place.
Yeah, we're very lucky. In the particular case of Binghamton, there's a guy named Charlie Hallinan, who was one of the founders of SBE. That's why Chapter 1 is there in Binghamton. And he kept a scrapbook of everything, all these applications, newspaper clippings, you name it, all went into the scrapbook of his. And it was preserved after he died, and the SBE chapter there actually scanned it all onto a CD that they sell. And it's fascinating because you really get an insight into that particular market and how that ended up the way it did. A lot of markets aren't that fortunate, and the stuff just gets lost.
Hmm.
So that's one of the things that I've tried to do is, you know, as I travel around, is as much as I can find these folks and preserve some of this history somewhere where it's all kind of brought together. It's important because there aren't enough people out there saving it.
Well, that is important, and if it's not appreciated now, I know it'll be appreciated in the future. I was looking back to New York at 1010 Winds, a station that I'm somewhat familiar with, and I know that Chris Tobin certainly is too. Tell me about that transmitter site, Chris and Scott together. What can you tell us about? It looks like you did some rebuilding in 1998 with some new towers.
Yeah, new towers went up in 98. The old four towers in a line had to come down. Pattern was let out a bit. There's a lot of good stuff. It was starting to show its age very quickly. And Winds was probably one of a few stations that operated with an STA for a long time for a reduced power. And that's probably one of the longest in history. But Wins got, let's say, Scott knows as well as I. It has a large history. There's lots going on at that site. Actually, the original site was in Carlstadt, New Jersey. And then it moved to where it is now in Lyndhurst.
Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Okay.
Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say there were a lot of these stations that ended up on sort of temporary dial positions. This is another thing that fascinates me, is that whole NARBA dial realignment that happened in 1941. And especially in New York City, there were some stations that didn't immediately land in their final positions. And Winds was actually one of those. It had been up. It was the outgrowth of a station that was called WGBS that had been operating on 1180. And it got moved. I think it was operating for a little while on 1000 before it moved all the way to 1010. And they moved around. There were a couple of stations that actually swapped transmitter facilities for a little while in New Jersey. They were trying to clean up interference. The Meadowlands area in New Jersey was one of the first areas where there were a lot of high power AM directionals all in very close proximity to one another. And I think it was really a learning experience for the engineers there in the early 40s to figure out the filtering, to figure out to what extent they could coexist and how they could avoid creating problems for one another. And to this day, there are some mighty filtering networks, as Tom can speak to, that prevent re-radiation from some of those towers.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Tom knows as I do. I could go out to one of my towers, one of any four. If I turn a knob on a coil, guaranteed I can take out 3-4 New York AM radio stations.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Oh, yeah, same here.
There was mutual, not interference, but controlled interference, I guess it would be the way to put, between all of the stations in that part of New Jersey, in the Meadowlands. No one is exempt. Matter of fact, when they did construction of the arenas, the sports arenas, the cranes, could sit in your transmitter room, watch your phase monitor, and as the cranes would swing around as they're hoisting girders and materials, your phase goes in and out, back and forth. I mean, Tom knows and others out there, for weeks and months, you just sat there going, okay, what do we do now?
The real funny thing was when they were building that Xanadu facility, which was behind the old WEPN transmitter site. That was about the same time they started the construction in our area where our new transmitter building is. And I was talking to one of the crane people one day, and I said, man, if I were you, I would not leave a crane up overnight or on the weekend and over there. And he said, why? I said, you're looking at 50 kilowatts, 500 feet away. A couple of weekends later, there were a whole bunch of guys mulling around on the site. Did you hear what happened? I said, no, what? They couldn't get any work done on that Monday because they left a crane up over the weekend. And all the nylon pulleys on the cranes melted.
Oh, no.
They had to take the cranes apart and replace all the nylon pulleys because of the 50 kilowatts from WEPN.
Whoa. Wow.
Oh, yeah. We had that problem in front of our array. If you do the ERP of our array, we're at 50,000 watt AM, but when you do the ERP, the gain of the antenna structure and stuff, it's almost double that. And we had a construction crew in front of the array about, I guess, a half a mile out, and it definitely did a number on our pattern. But we got a phone call, and they were in panic mode. They couldn't figure out what was going on. They were drawing sparks off their gear. And I said, well, where are you? He tells me the street. I'm like, okay, I tell you what, I'll reduce to low power for you, my non-directional pattern, and you guys can finish your work. But I'm going to tell you now, starting tomorrow, I can't do that. Here's what's going on. And they didn't know what to do. I told them, take a couple of battery cables and just clamp them to your rig, clamp them to a ground, and help drain off the RF. And sure enough, it worked for their particular spot they were in. But it was the wildest phone call.
And you know what? Out in that area, too, you learn a lot about RF safety that you normally wouldn't think about. At Chris's site and at my site as well, I mean, if you shut the transmitter off and just go out and touch the tower, you're going to get burned.
Oh, yeah!
You have to ground the tower. And I can draw an arc with a pair of jumper cables on my tower with our transmitter off. In addition, you don't take an extension cord and wrap it around your arm.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you do that and you accidentally touch the plug, you know you've touched that plug.
Oh, yes.
Sure.
Yeah, every couple of months, we try to go out and do any work and measurements and, you know, proof out the system and just check on things. It is so difficult. Yeah, we'll turn off the transmitter, plug a FIM or a bridge, you know, a OIB into a jack, test jack, and I'm picking up everybody. I mean, it's just, you want to learn you want to learn RF electronics and RF understanding and the black magic of RF, work in the Meadowlands. You'll definitely find stuff out.
It is unbelievable.
Tom Ray, your WOR transmitter is in the Meadowlands, and for folks who want to see it, they can go to Fibush.com and to the tower side of the week and just go through the New York listings and find WOR's new site.
There's 1, 2, 3 listings under New Jersey because that's where the transmitter is, and the old studios are located under the New York setting.
Okay, yes. Sorry, yes, you're
and
right.
And that has, I should point out, that's been another fascinating thing for me about New York, is watching the extent of studio reconstruction that has taken place there just in the last decade. I think just about every major cluster of stations there, with one exception, is in new studios compared to where they were about 10 years ago.
I think you're right.
Well, it's good for the equipment manufacturers, so we're not complaining. what I was going to drive at, though, was Chris Tobin, you at CBS, don't you have 3 high-power AM stations in the New York area?
Yes.
And
we have,
and how many of them are in the Meadowlands in the vicinity of Tom Ray's transmitter?
Just one.
Just WINS?
WINS, yes.
Okay.
The other two are located on an island, which we own, in Long Island Sound.
Wow.
WCBS AM and WFAN AM, a sports station, and the all-news station. And it's the only, as far as I know, and Scott, you can correct me, I believe it's the only diplexed AM, 250 kilowatts diplex on a single tower.
The only one in the U.S. There's one other one in North America.
That's correct.
The other one in North America is the old CBC site north of Toronto with 740 and 860 on it.
That's correct. I only say that because when we bring folks out, I'm sorry, Scott, go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say, actually, Barry Mishkin corrected me at one point when I made that point, because he pointed out that at least temporarily when they were doing work in Chicago, that WMVP was running with 50,000 watts on 1,000 from the WLS tower that had 50,000 watts on 890. But I contend that was just temporary. It was never licensed. It was only an STA. So, and Chris still gets the Medal of Honor for having the only one in the U.S.
I'll say, we're licensed full-time, diplex 50 kilowatts, and it's entertaining to go out to the base of the tower or to the phaser cabinet and with a fluorescent bulb in your hand. There's so much RF. I mean, most AM sites you can do this trick, but you come within 10 feet of the building, you're already illuminating the bulb. most sites you have to sort of be in the doghouse or the phaser cabinet near it and say, okay, here you go, here's what's going on.
It's fun to do that at night and tell the people that you're touring through the building that they can use the power of the Force now.
It's
like a lightsaber.
One time I gaffer tape a fluorescent bulb on the wall and I had a light switch next to it. And I said to somebody, do me a favor, turn off the lights. And they kept flipping the switch and it won't go out. I was like, oh, yes, I forgot. That's a special bulb we have. I pull it off the wall. And as I pull it off the wall, the light goes out around my hand but stays lit above and below. And I walk out the door. And the folks who were visiting from, I don't know where they were from, some other company, some communications company out of town, they just stood there and I could tell they were probably wetting their pants. Because the look on their face was, how do I get out of here? I don't know what's going on. I'm very scared. And it was great. It's fun stuff.
Chris Tarr, do you have any 50-kilowatt sites there? Or what's the highest you got there in Milwaukee?
Well, I don't have any personally. But, yeah, there's two in the market that are 50-kilowatt.
Oh, and they're TMJ in Milwaukee?
WTMJ and WISN, which are both on there, the 9 and the 6-tower arrays.
Ah, yeah, okay. Gotcha. And of course you don't have to have 50 kilowatts to do the fluorescent light trick.
I've got a 5-tower, 5-kilowatt. I can do it pretty easily.
I've done it with 1,000 watts.
Yes, well, so have I. It's great.
If you come to Nashville and get a tour of the WSM site, and I got that from Watt Hairston many years ago, but that's it's a pretty standard trick. It helps if it's near twilight. It's very impressive then.
I have some great video that I shot one day visiting WABC. And this was the middle of the day, and we're out there in the tuning house, and the fluorescent light was going up and down with the modulation from Rush Limbaugh on the speakers, and it was, you could just see that thing going on and off. It was beautiful.
On the website Tower Side of the Week here, I was looking for, but I just hadn't found yet the WCBS site. That's you said it's diplex with WFAN, was that correct?
It's listed as High Island.
High Island.
Oh, okay. High Island. Yep, oh, there it is.
It's about 10 down in the New York section.
So, and how many towers are there? Two?
Single
there's
tower,
one.
The
there's
main tower.
There's the main tower and then an aux.
Oh, okay. Main and aux. Okay. All right. Oh, very cool.
There's a neat picture. If you go about a third of the way down the page, there's a picture you can see off in the distance, this little man-made island called Columbia Island.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And I would love to have been there in its heyday, because all that's there now is just the building that was at the base. But there was a 500-foot-tall, 40-foot-face tower with a top hat that came out of the top of that building.
Wow.
And that was the old WCBS facility.
Yeah.
And they had a full-time engineering staff out there that had to be ferried out by rowboat from the shore in New Rochelle. And it must have been something. That was decommissioned in about 1963, so I missed it. But that's one of the all-time legendary sites that I will never get to see. And there are pictures out there.
And, boy, this is impressive on this WCBS High Island site with the 100,000 watts. I mean, you can't see it, but you can see the pipe that carries 100,000 watts from the building through an insulator to the tower. For our listeners who may not know, why is there a loop in your copper tubing between the tower and the building?
Because we like to do that.
No,
it's for the excess RF to drip off.
Oh, okay.
Right. You know, when you got a lot of it running through.
That's service loop.
That's right.
It's a service loop. So, when you move the tower to vacuum, you put it back.
Later. Yeah, there you go.
Oh. The tower back.
In fact, you only have one loop. I have like seven or eight. What are you? Jeez.
Oh, Jiminy.
That is a lightning arrester.
Yep. It does a little bit to slow the lightning down.
It's a very big inductor at lightning.
Yeah.
Yes. At that fast rise time of a lightning strike or corona discharge.
Now, we've been talking a lot about AM sites, but of course, Scott covers FM sites as well. And one of the interesting ones, I absolutely love going to the Empire State Building and getting a tour of people's transmitter sites there. I've been to the Z100 transmitter site in Empire, but I see that you've got the WPLJ transmitter site. Scott, what can you tell us about that? It's a good looking site, and you've got some nice pictures there.
It's a nice little room. It's a tiny little room. You know, a lot of those spaces at Empire were not very big to begin with. And they crammed a lot into there. That was the room that very famously, for many years in the 90s, when PLJ was running that incredibly crunchy processing, I had a big cover over their processing rack and a sign hanging over it that said, "Wouldn't you like to know?" Just to keep prying eyes away from it.
Nice.
That was quite popular here in town.
Yeah, that is up on the historic 85th floor of Empire.
Now, you say historic. I saw that in your article here. What's historic about the 85th floor of Empire?
That was where broadcasting began at Empire, right about at the time of the building of the 30s. NBC leased out that floor, and that was where they did a lot of their very earliest TV work. In fact, I had a chance at one point to see a blueprint of what that floor looked like in the early 30s. NBC had studios up there. For the very early experimental TV in the mid-30s, and before the big falling out with Edwin Armstrong, he was doing FM experimentation up there as well. And then he parted ways with RCA very dramatically and went on to build his own tower over in New Jersey, where he kept working.
Now, Armstrong Tower, they've got a set of pictures of him with the FM transmitter laid out on tables on the 85th floor.
I've seen reconstructions of that transmitter too, which is a neat thing to look at. But you get off the elevator there on 85,
mm-hmm.
and it really looks pretty much the way it would have looked when you first got off the elevator in 1931. All the marble paneling is still up on the walls, and you have a little Art Deco detailing. And it's fun because to get up there, that floor is only reachable by the same elevator that takes the tourists up to the observation deck on 86.
Oh,
and so you ride up with the tourists. And the door opens, and they're all thinking it's their time to get out, and you have to say, "Nope, not for you. Stay. Good tour."
It's true.
This is the secret floor. You can't see this.
And you walk off.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
They're missing the good stuff. That, of course, is also the floor that has the FM combiner room. And I am pretty sure that there is no other room in America through which more broadcast revenue passes on a continuous basis than that one room there, because it's got, I think, last count, 18 FM stations that all go through that combiner.
Yes.
On their way up to the master antenna, and they have they added several after 9/11. A few of the stations that had been at the World Trade Center moved up there, and they have ERI's got that room just jam packed, full of combiner. There's not much walking room in there anymore.
No, it's not. You're when you're in there doing work, it's it's talk about interaction between filter cavities. Elbow room is barely enough. Yeah, it takes a lot to keep it cool too.
Yeah, I can imagine. And of course, that also is a site that has no generator power in most of those rooms, and so most of those facilities in New York have managed to learn, you know, the lesson, which has been kind of a hard one sometimes over the last decade or so, that they'd better have a working backup site somewhere, or else they're going to be in trouble if something happens. And so one of the other interesting things for me has been getting to see all these backup sites. There's a facility over at Four Times Square that is more sophisticated, even though most of it is on the air only sporadically, is more sophisticated than, you know, most broadcast facilities anywhere else in the country.
We were lucky enough to get a tour of that site. I'm sorry, what's the engineer's name? Who was in charge of that?
John Lyons.
John Lyons, yes. Got a great tour of that site. It so happened that the day, a group of us went there, and my wife happened to be with us with that group, and she was just kind of taking all the transmitter sites, going ho-hum, you know, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. But it turns out they're filming Spider-Man 3 that day. They're filming some exterior shots of a skyscraper. It was Four Times Square. And so we saw the whole film crew up there, and my wife recognized a famous person in the film crew, and there was quite a bit of eye contact going back and forth. My wife saying, take a picture. And the guy's looking back at us saying, don't take my picture. You can read it in his eyes. Don't take my picture. So we did anyway. That Four Times Square site is interesting. But back on the subject of generators at Empire State Building, it seems that I've been in the Z100 room, and there was a generator in there, and they had to carry fuel up there in 5-gallon buckets to fill up whatever tank they have up there.
Right, there are a few that that were grandfathered up there, but yeah, they do. They have to carry their own fuel up, and you can imagine, you know, if the elevators are out, you want to be hauling jerry cans of fuel up 85 stories on your back. So everybody has pretty much gone to these full power aux facilities. That by the way, Four Times Square especially does really, really well.
Oh yes,
it's hard to tell sometimes when that site's on. Except for the fact they don't have HD up there on most of those transmitters. But other than that, you'd almost never know that they're on a backup facility. It's that good.
Wow. Well, we're running close to being out of time. I want to ask the panel if they've got any more questions before we turn to the subject of specifically Scott Feibusch's tower site calendar. Guys, you got any kind of wrap-up questions about your market or others?
I just have a question for Scott's Chris. Your love for this and your work that you've done is excellent. Are you able to make a living, quality of life with just what you're doing with the calendar and the and a few of the ancillary stuff I see on the site, or is there more to Scott's life to keeping family happy?
It ends up being a juggling act of about four or five different things that I do. Sort of the nominal full-time job is with the nice folks at Inside Radio, doing Radio Journal. And if you're not subscribing, go to theradiojournal.com and sign up for the weekly email. I like to think it's a pretty good compendium of what the FCC is up to on any given week. So that helps to pay the bills. Certainly the calendar pays for itself and some of the travel and not much more. It's very much a labor of love. I do some consulting with some of the station groups around the region, helping with strategic acquisitions, signal expansion, that kind of thing. And, a lot of it is really sort of the goodness of people who, either as advertisers or as subscribers, like what I do and think it's worth kicking in a few bucks to help to support. It's almost sort of the public broadcasting model in a way.
Oh, excellent.
So, Scott, let's talk about the calendar for a minute. Tell us about what this calendar is and why engineers are excited about it.
Well, a lot of them are excited because their sites are in them. As it's grown, I get people coming to me saying, oh, can I be in your calendar next year? And sometimes I'm able to say yes, and that makes me very happy. This is it's a full-color calendar. It started almost as sort of a whim in 01. I was starting to put up this Tower Site of the Week feature on the website, and a few people said, hey, you ought to make a calendar out of that. And I went to a local print shop here in Rochester and said, what would it cost to print up some calendars? And a friend of mine and I designed it, and we did a couple hundred. And lo and behold, they sold out. And so ever since, I've sold about 800 of them in any given year. It is this upcoming year's starts off with Boise, Idaho on the cover. The Deer Point site up above Boise, which is a really neat multiple tower site. It's got that rooftop site in L.A. that that I was talking about, the new 1050 site in New York is in there, and many, many more. And they are still they're still available, and it's also full of historic dates. There are all kinds of dates in there, primarily having to do with radio in the Northeast, of sign-ons and sign-offs, and Edwin Armstrong's birthday every December always seems to find a way in there. So,
we'll have these your websites in the show notes, but tell us where people can get the calendar. What do they need to do?
It is available at fibush.com, F-Y-B-U-S-H. And there's a handy link there to order the calendar. You can order online by PayPal, or you can send a check. They're $18 postpaid anywhere in the U.S. Or Canada.
Okay. All right. And the other site you mentioned was theradiojournal.com. That is a subscription site. Is that right?
That is a subscription site, but there's also a free email list you can sign up on that will at least get you the headlines every Wednesday when the newsletter comes out of what's in there. And, of course, Northeast Radio Watch and Tower Site of the Week also live at fibush.com. And then for Chris Tarr and the others who are really interested in hearing all those legal IDs, there is tophour.com.
Tophour.com. Wow.
Tophour.com. And just about every day of the week, one of the various co-editors of Top Hour, myself included, is putting up new IDs from somewhere all over this great land of ours.
That is so cool. That is so cool. I'll be checking those out, and I'm sure our listeners will too. So look for a bit of an increase in website hits.
Absolutely. We'll point them back your way, too. So what goes around comes around.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Scott, we really appreciate having you on. And I strongly suspect, Scott, that we're going to try to have you on again, maybe even doing a either a Tower Site of the Week or maybe a Tower Site of the Month, some kind of special vignette with a little bit of history from time to time.
I'd love it.
And our other co-host, thanks for being with us. Chris Tobin from New York, appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Tom Ray, also from New York. Thank you for being here, Tom.
Hey, anytime, Kirk. It's always a lot of fun. Scott, thanks for being here with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Hopefully I'll see you very soon down there.
And yeah, please stop in.
Chris Tarr, the Ninjaneer from Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being with us. I sure appreciate it. And thank you for listening. Tell your friends they can subscribe to This Week in Radio Tech on in the iTunes Store, or you can download it by RSS feed. You can be notified of it automatically. And you can always check us out at thisweekinradiotech.com. I'm Kirk Harnack. Thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.